I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The New Cold War. The Perils of the New Cold War. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History joins. Begins with the Ukraine crisis of 2013-2014. It accelerates well through 15 to here we are in 2016. Steve Cohen has at The Nation right now, in the magazine and on the website, a new article, a new editorial, The Obama Administration Recklessly Escalates Confrontation with Russia. He is here to comment and to explicate his piece. However, I begin with the headlines that underline that Steve Cohen's concerns for the breakdown in relationship between Moscow and Washington are very much seconded by major figures from the 20th century observing this, the senior Kremlinologists who are still with us, led by Dr. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, in all these years, a man who speaks very fluently of geopolitical relationships. Dr. Kissinger was in Moscow within this last week and to give a speech, and also to meet with the leadership, including Vladimir Putin. And I characterize his remarks as warning. Dr. Kissinger, I will go through the opening because it follows very much what we're about to discuss tonight. Dr. Kissinger says at the end of the Cold War, there was the promise of a strategic partnership between Russia and the United States because Russia was enjoying the flush of modernizing, of reconstructing after the failure of the communist dictatorship. The fate of both countries at that moment were intertwined and have remained so, except their motives have diverged. What are the motives in common? Stability, prohibiting the spread of WMD, security for Eurasia, and trade and investment for Eurasia, for Russia. The momentum, however, for the possibilities at the end of the Cold War these last 25 years have been, according to Dr. Kissinger's language, outstripped the statesmanship that is available. What has happened in the intervening years? To begin with, there was Russian protest of the NATO involvement in the breakup of Yugoslavia that very much worried the Russians because it was close to the Russian frontier. After that, there was the cooperation in Afghanistan against al-Qaeda. That was following the attacks on the United States. But that was interrupted by the invasion of Iraq, which very much upset the leadership in the Kremlin, seeing that as an extra-legal activity by the United States and upsetting the relationships that Russia had established throughout the Middle East. Following that, things got much worse. The Caucasus in 2008, that's Georgia and Abkhazia, then Ukraine in 2014, and now Syria in 2015, all leading us to a point that Dr. Kissinger says is when both sides demonize the other over the affairs in the Balkans, over former Soviet territory, over the Middle East, over NATO expansion, over missile defense, over arms sales. So here we are, 25 years after the end of the Cold War, and for the U.S., no longer is the Cold War vindication of the U.S.'s policies. It is, in fact, reintroduced as the U.S., one more time, a quest to break Russia, break Russia's aggression. From the Russian point of view, Russia sees the U.S. and its claim of investment and its claim of capitalism and its claim of trade as an invasion. Russia's history is complicated, reminds Henry Kissinger. The idea of people breaking into Russia and dominating the people of Russia. That's the concern about NATO's expansion. So I come to the professor tonight, following his article in The Nation, to say that Dr. Kissinger last week spoke to a very receptive audience in Moscow. Would those words be welcomed in Washington? Good evening to you, Steve.
I don't think so, but give me the luxury of a little digression at the top before we come to the dire moment we've approached, recalling that last week we thought it was dire. What is it, more dire or even dire? Two men who could be considered major American statesmen of the 20th century have spoken out essentially against Washington policy, and both are older than 90 years old. Henry Kissinger, whom I think is about 93, and William Perry, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, has published a book and articles in which he says that the danger of nuclear war, and remember, he was in charge of our nuclear weapons 20 years ago, is greater today than it was during the preceding Cold War. That seems to me to be a deeply alarming, and not alarmist, but alarming message from a man who's been there and done that. And now comes Kissinger in Moscow, the purpose of the trip to meet with Putin. They're old friends. They met back in St. Petersburg in the early 90s, I believe, when Putin was like a vice mayor of St. Petersburg. They've stayed in touch, and they meet once a year. They have a kind of ritual. That Kissinger would say in the speech he gave in Moscow that leadership is falling behind the crisis of our time clearly is not directed at Putin. It can only be directed at Europe and the White House. Now, Kissinger always speaks somewhat obliquely, but the message is very clear. I don't know how that makes you feel, John. It makes me, being older, and I've been feeling really old lately, feel like, as Clinton once said, 60 really is only middle age or something like that. But these guys in their 90s are leading at that level the call that something has to be done, and it has to be done quick. And here's the evidence since we spoke last week. And I'll just rattle off what has happened. And you can decide what you think we should talk about, because it's all so bad that I'm not sure what we should spend our time on tonight. Last week, we talked at length about the Obama administration's decision. It was announced by the Secretary of State, Ash Carter, but he works for Mr. Obama, assuming Mr. Obama is still our foreign policy president. It's not always clear. That NATO and the United States were quadrupling their military forces on Russia's borders. And that is now underway. It only came to me when we were talking last week, John, that this is the first time since the German invasion that so much Western power, that any Western power, has been amassed on Russia's borders. And in Russia, that rings a historical bell, invasion. And Russia has already begun to react. And is going to react in ways we discussed last week, including, I would guess, moving their tactical nuclear weapons closer to the Western borders. But just when you think things can't get worse, they did since we talked. And it's been driven, and I hope your listeners will forgive me, because we do practice propaganda. The worst American propaganda campaign that I've seen, certainly since the height of the Cold War, denunciations of Putin, denunciations of everything Russia does, from Ukraine to Europe to Syria, headlines in the Washington Post, because we don't need a government propaganda organization. We've got the mainstream media. Headline in the Washington Post, front page, February 6th, Russia defies the United States in Syria. In another publication, Russia threatening the Baltics. In another publication, Russia refuses to implement the Minsk negotiations in Ukraine. Russia may be defying the United States because it has different thinking about how to solve a problem. But this is just warmongering on the front page of the Washington Post and other newspapers. So here's what's happened. The military aspects of the new Cold War in Europe have been escalated. We saw that last week with NATO's decision to quadruple American NATO forces on Russia's borders. And, of course, Russia's beginning to react. You reported already they're staging military operations in their south and west near Ukraine. But may we point out that that's inside Russia's territory? NATO is moving from the east toward Russia, from the west toward Russia. Then, just as it seemed that Kerry had worked out a way, Kerry, Merkel, and Hollande of Germany and France, to get the Ukrainian negotiations going, because that remains the political pivot of the Cold War, the president of Ukraine announces he's not going to do what he said he was going to do, and he didn't put any date on it. He was supposed to sign on February 2nd. He announced officially he's not going to do it. And he got his parliament to pass a resolution that he didn't have to sign these documents, which he's obliged to sign. And he signed the repudiation of those documents immediately. It's a slap in the face to Europe, unless Europe approves of that. Now we go to Syria. It looked, for a while, with the Geneva discussions that Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov had gotten going about a political process, that the United States and Russia were going to form a diplomatic and military coalition against the Islamic State, that we were going to drop our demand that Assad, the president of Syria, be removed immediately, and we were going to have a process. And instead, the process has broken down, not because of anything the Russians did, though I'll amend that in a moment, but because the so-called moderate opposition, most of whom appear to be terrorists of one kind or another, didn't show up. What I interpret this to be is that, though it's not reported here, the Russian air campaign, along with Iranian troops and Kurdish troops, are dealing a devastating blow to the Islamic State in Syria. It appears that the Syrian army will, maybe by next week, take back Aleppo, the largest city in Syria, from the Islamic State. Now, it has created a refugee flow. But war creates refugee flows. And the Islamic State generated a couple million refugees. By the highest count, the Russian campaign has generated 2,000. There's no way to fight it. It may sound inhumane, but is there any way to fight the Islamic State without driving refugees away from the battle?
Just a minute, Steve. We'll continue because we're talking about Russia's conflict in Syria with the Islamic State and the so-called rebels, which are al-Qaeda. But Russia is also in conflict with Turkey. That's where the rebels, that's where the Russian forces in Aleppo are driving those refugees. And Russia is very concerned with its enmity with Turkey. This is part of the scenario. I'm speaking with Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. We're talking about the new Cold War in all of the theaters deteriorating each week. Worse and worse. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm speaking with Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History, about the new Cold War. And Steve, pointing to the examples of how the condition, how the relationship between Moscow and Washington is worse week to week, was evidencing the deterioration of the conditions in Syria, creating more refugees as the Russian support of the Assad regime and its allies, the Hezbollah and the Iranians, are sweeping into Aleppo province, driving into the city of Aleppo and driving refugees up against the Turkish border. But I note, as the professor did, Russia is conducting military exercises right now, which are characterized by NATO as surprise military exercises. And those exercises are not only along the Ukraine border, they're also said by a commentator from the Russian military to be, quote, a little signal to Turkey, where the relations have become what the Russians characterize as severely strained. So, Steve, it's not just about NATO pointing a finger at Russia for its military exercises on the Ukrainian border. NATO is also pointing a finger at Russia for its little signal to Turkey, which I remind everybody is a member of NATO. Please continue, Steve.
You made what was going to be my next point, that if we generalize about the new Cold War, which is heating up, that's what we're talking about. And the propaganda is heating up, and the military movements are heating up. We've mentioned Europe, we've mentioned Ukraine, we've mentioned Syria. And just when you had to go to the break, I think we have to add Turkey to a theater, a front in the new Cold War. And it looks to me, from what Turkey has been doing ever since it shot down that Russian airplane, that fighter plane, and what it's been doing since, that some people in Turkey, whoever's controlling the political situation, is trying to provoke a war with Russia in order, because Turkey is a member of NATO, to draw NATO into a war with Russia. This may be even more dangerous than the other fronts at the moment. But what we have in the last week is an escalation militarily on all these fronts and a breakdown on at least two of the fronts, Ukraine and Syria, where it appeared that Washington and Moscow might work together. When I look at this, and we can talk about conspiracies, we can talk about the forces who are opposed to negotiation, two things strike me. Last week, officially, the American Secretary of State, Ash Carter, announced officially that Russia is the number one enemy of the United States, the greatest threat to the United States in the entire world. He then went on to rank the others. I forget the exact order, but I believe it was China after Russia, North Korea after China, and last, the Islamic State. I mean, think of the mind change since what happened in Paris, or even in California. But now, international terrorism, which could strike where you live or I live at any moment, is now number four, and Russia's number one. And that leads me to wonder, if some years ago, people in Washington, somebody, didn't declare a jihad against Putin personally, and that explains some of this demonization of Putin, of accusing him of killing people and secretly stolen $4 billion and all this stuff that's coming out of Washington, and that these people, as I see it, are putting this jihad against Putin, clearly they want regime change in Russia, above America's national interest, way above it, because clearly if North Korea gets an intercontinental missile, and it already has nuclear weapons, that is extremely dangerous. And the Islamic State and its affiliates have already demonstrated its power to strike. Have we forgotten 9/11? So, and all this accompanied by a propaganda war coming. I mean, the Russians, of course, do propaganda. Of course they do. Everybody does propaganda. Your propaganda is my truth. But the volume and the distortion and the lack of any respect for facts in what's pouring out of American publications against Russia is, I'm not even sure in my lifetime, maybe the Cuban Missile Crisis, but even then people were so worried they calmed down.
We'll continue.
I've seen anything like that.
I want to mention the economy too, Steve, because that's part of the demonization. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. When we continue the new Cold War and the economies of the new Cold War, I'm John Batchelor. Later in the program, historian Mark Morris follows the failure of King John of England to the showdown at Runnymede and the creation of the profound Magna Carta. John Batchelor, podcast always ready at johnbatchelorshow.com. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm speaking with Professor Stephen F. Cohen of the new Cold War and the deterioration week to week since the moment in mid-January when it appeared possible that there could be a rapprochement, that Minsk II could be initiated, and that the parties in Moscow and in Washington would come to terms over Crimea, over Ukraine, over Syria. That is breaking down week to week now with what is generally understood, Dr. Kissinger uses the terms, the demonizing of each other, and especially the demonizing of Moscow, personally demonizing the villain, Vladimir Putin. But I mentioned part of the attack on Moscow is to always bring up the fact that the elite of Russia, the well-to-do, are panicking to say that the economy is deteriorating much more dramatically than expected. And I'll read this most recent analysis. The elite's growing anxiety is beginning to move from the domestic to the international arena. Russia is now considering suspending its loans to foreign countries. According to the Financial Times in December, Vladimir Putin allegedly asked Syrian President Assad to step down. The move was in contradiction to all statements of public support. It goes on and on like this. These are routine reports that we see everywhere in Washington, part of the war party, making it very clear that Russia can't last much longer. They even point in the war party to the meeting between Victoria Nuland and Vladislav Surkov, representing the Kremlin, in the middle of January, which we regarded at the time as possibly a change in the weather, an improvement of relations, pointing to that now as a chance for the war party to deliver an ultimatum that unless you do this by such and such a date, your economy is going to collapse to the point that you will have disorder in the streets. Steve, I emphasize that. It's routine now to say that the Russian economy is deteriorating to the point that the government is going to lose control and that the people of Russia will be plunged into anarchy. They're threatening all of Europe with anarchy unless Vladimir Putin changes his way.
Well, let's start at the end of the story. Let us imagine, as these regime changers in our country, and not only, want that Putin falls, Russia falls into anarchy, the largest territorial country in the world, with 88 different provinces stretching from Europe to the Arctic, and laden with every known manner of weapon of mass destruction. Not only nuclear weapons, but biological and chemical weapons, and nuclear reactors galore. Imagine that happened. No one in the world would be safe. It would become a Walmart for every terrorist in search of a weapon mass destruction. Therefore, I say that those people in the United States who are promoting that regime change policy in Russia are unfit to hold office because they're endangering all of us. They're endangering the world. But that isn't going to happen. Let's go to something approaching the reality of the pains of Putin and his economy at the moment. I'm not an economist. I can't even read technical economic works. But I follow the people I regard to be the best economists in Russia, and they are very outspoken. It's not true that no debate occurs in the Russian press. They're arguing among themselves how bad the situation is and what's to be done. In addition, there are a number of American economists who are never approached by our mass media, who also have different points of view. I think what I'm about to say now is the balanced view. Russia is hurting today economically, but not primarily because of the Western sanctions, primarily because of the drop in the price of oil, world oil. As everyone knows, Russia is a major world exporter of natural gas and oil, and internationally, the price of the two are pegged. Oil has dropped from close to 100 down, I don't know what it is today, 33 or 34 a barrel. Russia's budget was originally pegged to have no deficit, pay all its bills at home and abroad, at about $80 a barrel. It then recast the budget for 50. Now it's saying it can make do for 3 or 4 years at 40. But everybody's hurting in Russia. Prices are up. Inflation's up. There is grumbling. There are complaints. Just recently I read in a very widely read mainstream newspaper direct criticism of Putin that he was spending too much time on foreign policy and not enough on domestic policy. That's something we see in all countries of the world. When the country's involved in Cold War or hot war and things get tough at home, the leader gets blamed. And yet his positive ratings, approval for the job he's doing, remain in excess of 80%. He's not in danger, partly because there's no alternative to him, but he's not in danger. The second thing to be said here is that Putin's not a dictator. He cannot make, on his own, unilateral foreign or domestic policies. This is a complicated discussion about the nature of the Russian political system, the nature of its authoritarian structure, the roles played by powerful groups and bureaucracies. But a group, and we estimate that to be maybe 15 to 20 people, have an opinion, and a divided opinion. Ultimately, Putin is the decider, but he can't defy that group. If they all want X and he does Y, he's got a problem. Now, another view in Russia is this. Russia still has, I don't know the exact number, but maybe approximately $300 billion in its hard currency reserves. It also has a lot of gold. That is, it can pay its bills, both to its own people, Social Security, medical care, all the rest, provide subsidies, pay foreign debt, sovereign debt, to foreign banks, without belling up, probably for at least a year and a half or 2 years. So this is not some imminent financial collapse, because that's really what people are talking about, that Russia can't pay its bills. So it's not like Russia was back in when its financial system collapsed in 1998-99, when it had no foreign reserves. It still has foreign reserves, though it is burning them up at a fast pace. It's not supporting the ruble any longer. Now, we go to the ruble. There is this belief that the devaluation of the ruble will eventually, and everything hangs on the word eventually, create a much better Russian economy. Russia was much, much, much too dependent on Western goods and Western credit as a result of what happened in the 1990s. For example, in the 1990s, Russia's poultry industry collapsed. Russia's pharmaceutical industry collapsed. And in other kind of domestic-centered manufacturing. What's happening now is the government is going all out to revive those industries. The problem is they can't get foreign credit because of the sanctions. That's where the sanctions come in. They can hang on, but they don't have the resources at the moment for new investment. Now, they've turned to the Chinese. They've turned to the BRICS nation. They've provided some. But China now has its own economic problems. So you're getting something of a perfect storm here for Russia. Its ally, China, has its own economic problems. The Western sanctions shut Russia off from either refinancing or borrowing, getting new credits. And it's devalued the ruble. But this notion of import substitution is not a fiction. And here's an example. Russia was importing about 90% of its food. That's preposterous for a country that's essentially one of the largest agricultural countries in the world. This last year, 2015, agriculture did extremely well in Russia for two reasons. State banks provided credit to large producers. And suddenly, small farmers realized, okay, there's no French cheese in Moscow. We're going to make the cheese. So if you go to Moscow today, you know, the people who want to eat French cheese are unhappy. But most Russians who eat a lot of cheese are perfectly happy to eat Russian cheese. And the same is true with other products that now don't come from abroad. So this argument is that Russia is going to go through 2 or 3 years of hard economic times. But at the end of the road, Russia is going to be a much more independent country economically, and it will cut those ties to a minimum with the West, and it will now have its economic center not in Europe the way it's been, but in the East, and, you know, Latin America and other countries are not in on these sanctions. So things could get very bad, but not quickly.
I want to ask, Steve, about, because part of the argument made by those who make the case that Russia will break is this paragraph, for example. This is from William E. Pomerantz, who is deputy director of the Kennan Institute of the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington. He writes, "The public has responded stoically and largely without panic, even as they see their middle-class aspirations crash." He's talking about Russia in the recession. "But a whiff of desperation can now be sensed, and it is the Kremlin that appears the most perplexed about what the next steps it should take." I ask this, Steve, because I read history of Russia, the last 100 years, the last 200 years. The Russians have a sense of common purpose when it comes to resisting invaders and pressures from the outside that is discontinuous with what we have in the United States. Is that being taken into account, Steve? Its history of invasion and how it will suffer the worst deprivations in order to get rid of or to shed the idea of being taken over?
I don't know if it's being taken into account. Will Pomerantz is sitting in Washington sniffing something in Moscow. I don't know how he sniffs all the way from Washington to the Russian provinces. The reports I get from my Russian friends who actually live in the provinces, or in Moscow is, and St. Petersburg, the capital, is there's a lot of grumbling. People are unhappy, but they don't blame their own government. That's the key thing. And the polling that takes place in Russia, some of it's cooked, but there are two or three agencies, including American agencies, Gallup and others, who do survey polling in Russia. There's no evidence that the Russian people, and by the way, in hard times, it's not the elite that suffers.
Right.
In hard times, it's the lower middle class, working people, and the poor.
And the pensioners, especially.
Pensioners especially. But that's one thing that the Putin government will not cut. I mean, they will do everything possible, and they index the pensions, and they increase them every year. That's their red line. They're not going to let those pensions be damaged. By the way, one reason is, in Russia, which where life is somewhat different, though we're beginning to see this here, where kids who graduate from college because of the lousy American economy go back home and live with their parents. In Russia, a lot of kids still live with their parents who are on pensions, or even their grandparents. So the pension's being paid in Russia. The pensionable age in Russia is much younger here. For women, it's 55. For men, it's 60. Now, Putin wants to raise the pensionable age, and in fact, they should, because people are now living in Russia. But you know the opposition to that proposal here in the United States about Social Security. A lot of people are against it. Everybody's against it in Russia. The point here is that the point you raised is that there is no evidence that the people, and I don't want to say they're suffering. They're in harder times now, because Russians never enjoyed the kind of upper middle class life that we've enjoyed in this country, many of them. In fact, the Russian middle class, as an economically stable middle class, is overwhelmingly made up of people who work for the federal government, not private entrepreneurs,
right,
mom and pop. It's a completely different kind of middle class. And because it works for the state, it's faithful to the state, because it depends on the state being stable. It's not insurrectionist in regard to the state. So you've got a different political culture there. It's not worse than ours. It's not better than ours. It's different.
The right way, the wrong way, and the Russian way. I'm speaking to Professor Stephen F. Cohen. That's a Russian proverb. New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. When we come back, one more check on Dr. Kissinger's remarks last week, because they are poignant at the same time a warning. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. The closing remarks from Dr. Kissinger's speech in Moscow the week past, this at the Gorchakov Fund, and you can find it at the Gorchakov Fund website. That's Gorchakov. I have spent the greater part of the past 70 years engaged in one way or another in the U.S.-Russian relations. I have been at decision centers when alert levels have been raised, and at joint celebrations of diplomatic achievement. Our countries and the peoples of the world need a more durable prospect. I am here to argue for the possibility of a dialogue that seeks to merge our futures rather than elaborate our conflicts. This requires respect by both sides of the vital values and interests of the other. These goals cannot be completed in what remains of the current administration. but neither should their pursuits be postponed for American domestic politics. It will only come with a willingness in both Washington and Moscow, in the White House and the Kremlin, to move beyond the grievances and sense of victimization to confront the larger challenges that face both of our countries in the years ahead. Steve, those two paragraphs speak to everything that you have been maintaining these last 2 years, that to set aside the grievances and the victimization and talk about a world of parallel development for Russia and the United States. But I take it from Dr. Kissinger's tone that he does not believe this is coming quickly, and I know you do not.
No, I disagree on one, and I, you know, I've had my disagreements with Dr. Kissinger over the years, when he was in power and when he was out of power. But what he says today is truth. It's our national security. But you can hear the melancholy and
yes.
the poignancy in his words, because he's very much in the twilight of his life. And what he tried to build, which was a stable international order where Russia and the United States, which each would each play a rightful and respected role, he sees going down the drain. When he says that the solution is far off, I think we can't take that position, that it's gotten so dangerous that we need at least what we used to call a mini detente. We need negotiations begun immediately.
Immediately, now,
immediately.
This month, yes.
And there are three possibilities that are there on the table if there was a leader to pick them up. One is Ukraine. The road to a negotiated settlement of the Ukrainian crisis that would keep the rebel territories in Ukraine, which is vital. And by the way, that's what Putin insists, that the rebels stay in Ukraine, though they're arguing with him about that. That is there. A coalition between the United States and Russia against the Islamic State in Syria.
That's the second one.
Is a no-brainer.
Right.
And the other thing is, we have below the radar, you and I mentioned it elliptically, a new nuclear arms race.
Right.
And it's got to stop. Leave aside getting rid of nuclear weapons now. We've got to prevent the building of new and more lethal.
Well, both sides are doing it right now. They're not only upgrading, Steve, they're putting new missiles on. Russia is and the United States is.
I understand. But, you know, John, they invented leadership for a purpose. And that is to do what is not easy to do, to see farther than the rest of us see. What was it Churchill once said? A politician thinks about today. A statesman thinks about tomorrow. We do not have, on the political landscape in the United States today, such a person in power or anywhere near power, so far as I can see. You and I had thought that Mrs. Merkel might be such a person.
We have a minute, Steve.
She has crumbled. We thought that maybe Hollande, for all his comical antics on Vespas a few years ago and girlfriends and the rest, was rising after Paris to try to play that role. But France simply lacks the stature in world affairs. The reality is that the most consequential, for better or worse, statesman of the 21st century sits in the Kremlin. That's the reality, whatever you want to call him. He is the consequential statesman, and we need a consequential statesman to act at a minimum on these three perilous fronts where agreement is possible, but where the will is lacking.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. The article in The Nation right now about the dire situation. It will be worse a week from now when I speak to the professor again. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Later in the program, historian Mark Morris follows the failure of King John of England to the showdown at Runnymede and the creation of the profound Magna Carta. John Batchelor, podcast always ready at johnbatchelorshow.com.